You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, February 7th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, to discuss his latest piece in The Nation magazine, Ari Berman, on the attempts of Republicans and conservatives to overthrow the Voting Rights Act that has been in place in this country for now 36 years? 40 years? 46 years. And also to help me with simple addition and subtraction, Ari Berman. Also on the program today, the OLC memo that we spoke of yesterday that had yet to be released is now been released by the Obama administration. If you listened to the program yesterday, you heard Attorney Scott Horton talk about that 50-page memo, which was summarized in the 16-page white paper that has now been released at least to members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, literally hours before John Brennan, the CIA chief nominee, to face a confirmation hearing in the Senate today at 2:30 p.m. Also, interesting reasoning behind the New York Times, the Washington Post, and perhaps other major media outlets for not telling us about a semi-secret drone base in Saudi Arabia. Hearings yesterday in New York on the NDAA. We will get to that. Marco Rubio revealed as a climate change denier, sort of, but yeah, uh-huh. And in Michigan, another swipe at the vaginal ultrasound bill. Meanwhile, the ongoing brewing war within the Republican Party. People have got to get paid. And an amazing story of two, I guess, daughters of the Phelps family who have left the Westboro Baptist Church. All that and more. Let's get to this story about the release of the drone memos. The New York Times reports the White House on Wednesday directed the Justice Department to release to the two congressional intelligence committees classified documents discussing the legal justification for the use of drones in targeting American citizens abroad who are considered terrorists. I mean, even the way the New York Times reports on this is problematic. Because they are considered terrorists by the same people who determine whether or not it's legal to do this. I mean, they are suspected terrorists. That is the point here, or one of them. The White House announcement appears to refer to a long, detailed 2010 memo from the Justice Department. Yesterday on this program, Scott Horton referred to this document as being 50 pages long, written at least by one of the White House Department of Justice attorneys, Marty Lederman, justifying the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American-born cleric who had joined al-Qaeda in Yemen. Again, not just American-born, in fact, an American citizen. And it also involved the killing of two other individuals, one who was with al-Awlaki at the time. The other was al-Awlaki's son, a 16-year-old boy, who was killed 2 weeks later. Critics noted in 2009, Mr. Obama had ordered the public release of the classified memos governing the CIA interrogations under President George W. Bush and accused the president of hypocrisy. This whole hypocrisy charge is the way that polite people get a chance to discuss this issue without really getting to the nub of it. I don't know if it's hypocritical of President Obama to release torture documents and not release this. Perhaps it is. If it is an issue at all involved in this, it is somewhere down around on the list of probably the 12th or 15th offense involved in this. The issue isn't that the president's being hypocritical in not releasing these documents. The issue is that there's a secret law that allows the administration or the executive, not just this administration, and that's also the point. It allows the executive, the president of the United States, to kill an American citizen if they determine without any judicial review that that person deserves killing. That is the problem here. The hypocrisy is a complete red herring. If it was only about hypocrisy, then it would be like any other story. And I guess that's sort of the point as to why they push it. Administration officials said Mr. Obama had decided to take the action out of a desire to involve Congress in the development of the legal framework for the drones. That's also BS. If that was the motivation, we would have seen the release of these documents 2 years ago, or when the Senate Intelligence Committee was calling for them months and months ago. Though aides noted that Mr. Obama had made a pledge to do that during an appearance on The Daily Show last year. I Wow. The legal memos or memos are not being shared with either the Armed Service Committee, which have jurisdiction over the Pentagon strikes, or the Judiciary Committee, which oversees the Justice Department. Ron Wyden, who has been talking about this at least elliptically over the months, apparently at a Democratic retreat on Wednesday had vowed to, quote, pull out all the stops to get the actual legal analysis, because without it, in effect, the administration is in effect practicing secret law, hinting at a potential filibuster of John Brennan. And that really is the issue, that this was the administration's tit for tat in trying to get the Brennan nomination to sail through the Senate. We'll see if it does. Remember, Republicans are complaining about this because it's hypocritical. But at the same time, we applaud the killing. And I guess on some media outlets, including the liberal one, some people are saying, yeah, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? We will talk more about this as the show progresses. Interesting endorsement of the Brennan nomination by the special investigator from the UN to delve into the issue of the U.S. drone policy. We will talk about that as the show progresses, but we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Ari Berman about the upcoming Supreme Court case involving the Voting Rights Act. This is going to be the most important case that the Supreme Court will deal with, maybe more so than even Citizens United, but certainly since then. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
my camera on. I cut my fingers on the way. On the way. The way of slipping away. I turned my feelings on. You made me untouchable for life. Yeah, yeah. And you wasn't the man.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome to the program, contributor to The Nation, author of Herding Donkeys. Of course, I am referring to Ari Berman. Ari, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Sam.
Always a pleasure, Ari. I want you to know, let's start this off with the important stuff. There are people on Twitter who are just outraged. They want to see the receipts. They want to see the canceled check. They want to see the cash that you owe me for all the bets that we've made in the past. And I'm just
Sam. I think you have the distinction of being the only person I know who won't actually cash in on their winning bet because I've offered you on numerous occasions dinner at Nobu.
Really? Seriously?
Based on our 2008 bet, and you have turned it down.
No, then, I haven't turned it down. I'll take it right now.
Then you went double or nothing, which I believe that you somehow, in spite of all logic, were able to win. Then I credited you on Twitter while also demanding a recount, but I did credit you.
Yeah.
And there was a conspicuous silence from your Twitter account, which really upset me.
I'm in heavy negotiations to see if I'm allowed to go out and have a dinner at Nobu without bringing my family. And so that's what's slowing. That's the wheels of progress move slowly. All right, let's.
I mean, I know how you want to avoid page six.
So I'm waiting for another 4 years so I can triple this money. I'm starting to look at this as my soon to be born child's second child's college fund, actually. So
I hope you think of another revenue stream. As
well, I'm hoping for huge success, Ari. And with pieces like this blockbuster piece in The Nation magazine on entitled Conservatives Take Aim at Voting Rights, we have a link up at majority.fm. This is you've been on the attack on voting rights by conservatives. You've been on this beat for a couple of years now, and we've certainly seen its implications in many respects, particularly in Congress, in terms of gerrymandering in such a way that is borderline in some instances, could arguably be violation of the Voting Rights Act in some respects, but certainly it has really perverted in many ways the electoral process. But before we go to that, let's talk specifically about the Voting Rights Act. What was the impetus, obviously, for the Voting Rights Act and specifically Section 5? Tell us, just give us a little background on the Voting Rights Act.
Sure. So I'll just give you a brief history of American politics in 30 seconds. But we all know the Civil
Take
War
45.
Ended in 1865, right? There was a brief Reconstruction period when there were black senators, black congressmen, and black majorities in the South, which a lot of people don't seem to realize. Federal troops were pulled out of the South in 1877 as part of a compromise as a result of the disputed presidential election of 1876. Thus really began the Jim Crow period in the South when you had Southern state legislatures pass things like literacy tests, poll taxes, grandfather clauses, all-white primaries, and what you had is a situation where blacks went from being the majority in some states to essentially their being zero registered voters throughout the South among African Americans. And you had a situation up until the Voting Rights Act of 1965 when an entire population was disenfranchised in a very large region of the country. And so even though the 15th Amendment was passed in 1870 to prevent discrimination in voting, saying that you couldn't discriminate on basis of race, color, or condition of servitude to be able to vote, the 15th Amendment really didn't become the enacted law of the land in any practical purpose until the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was so important because it fulfilled the promise of the 15th Amendment by guaranteeing the right to vote, first for African Americans and then for other minority groups later on. And what it did is it not only abolished things like poll taxes and literacy tests, it not only mandated that federal registrars would register people to vote, so it registered millions of black Americans in the South and later Hispanic and other minority groups. But what it also did most critically, and this is Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, is Section 5 said to parts or all of 16 states with a history of racial discrimination in voting, that they had to clear their election changes with the federal government. So the onus was now on the states to prove that their voting changes were not discriminatory and not on the federal government to have to intervene to block those states after they were put into effect. So that change really wiped out a generation of voter suppression, and that is what is being challenged right now before the Supreme Court.
How, you know, we've talked about this in the past, and obviously we've talked about Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act on this program and with you in the past. How was that determination made? I mean, you know, on its face it makes sense, but I mean, how do you know how they specifically came about to say these 16 counties have a history of disenfranchisement?
Yeah.
I mean, what was the mechanism?
They knew originally the states that they wanted to cover, and then they reverse engineered the formula to be able to cover them. So they wanted to cover essentially the six main states of the Deep South and then go from there. And what they did is they based it on two criteria. One was whether states as of the 1964 election had voter registration rates for African Americans below 50%, and whether in that same election they had something like a poll tax or a literacy test on the books. And that was able to cover states like Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana and South Carolina and Georgia and parts of North Carolina. Then it was expanded to bring in states that discriminated against language minority groups. So, for example, Hispanic voters, and that brought in Texas. And then other states over time were brought in, places like Virginia, and then parts of other states were covered as well. And what we find is the coverage formula of the act, which is being challenged right now, the states that are under Section 5 is being challenged, but it's fascinating to me that the same states that essentially discriminated against minority voters in 1964 are still the worst actors today. Nine full states, primarily in the South, are covered by the Voting Rights Act, and two-thirds of those states passed some sort of new voting restriction since the 2010 election. So that's two-thirds of those states. If you look at the states that aren't covered by Section 5, which is basically two-thirds of the country, only a third of those states passed new voting restrictions. So it certainly is true that there are states that aren't covered by Section 5, like Ohio and Pennsylvania, that are doing voter suppression. I don't think anyone's denying that. But the worst states are still those places like Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, South Carolina, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, so there's an argument in some respects that rather than curtailing Section 5, we should actually be extending it. I mean, frankly, it seems to me that we should be. There's no reason not to extend it to every state. I mean, for that matter,
well,
right?
I don't think it's necessary to extend it to every state for two reasons. Number one, I don't think every state has the same level of problems that you have in a place like Alabama. I also think that it would be a tremendous amount of work for the Justice Department to have to review every single voting change that comes from places like Oregon that's not discriminating against voters. Actually, conservatives who don't like the Voting Rights Act have advocated that as a way to kill it, and people have said, well, some people love the Voting Rights Act so much they'd like to kill it. But I do think that this is certainly on the heels of a presidential election, the last election in which voter suppression was such a big deal. It seems particularly ironic to be discussing killing a key part of the Voting Rights Act right after an election that proved that voter suppression is still alive and well, and not only alive and well, but is really expanding, not contracting.
Let's before we get into, you know, who's behind this and sort of previewing this case in front of the Supreme Court, let's, if you'll indulge me, because we've had this conversation, I think, in the past in terms of the problems that we've seen with voting and the use of redistricting to essentially disenfranchise voters. the concept that there is no federal right to voting. I mean, I think in the past I've said that's the case, but that's not really. I mean, this is an arguable issue. Now we know that Justice Scalia believes that there is no federal right to vote. In your piece, I think you've interviewed Professor Bagnan Tsosis. I can't pronounce it. There are aspects in the Constitution which at least suggest that there is a federal right to vote. Article 1, Section 4 gives Congress authority after the states have had their chance at it. In terms of federal elections, it allows for Congress to have authority over the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives. That would be congresspeople. And so there is at least some implication that the federal government, that there is a right to vote because a federal right to vote, I should say, because Congress has some affirmative rights and responsibilities in ensuring or at least being able to exercise some jurisdiction on how those votes are taken.
Well, and my own feeling is that voting is mentioned a number of different times in the Constitution. So my feeling is that instead of trying to pass a new constitutional amendment that would guarantee the right to vote, which is an idea that Jesse Jackson Jr. had, which is certainly worthwhile, I think it makes more sense to enforce the existing statutes that are there. And for the purposes of the Voting Rights Act, the 15th Amendment is very, very clear that it says the right to vote, quote, shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So for the purposes of the Voting Rights Act, there is a fundamental right to vote, and you can't deny that right to vote on the basis of race or color. Now, the problem was before the Voting Rights Act of 1965 took effect, there was no way to enforce it. And what the Voting Rights Act did is it was essentially an enforcement mechanism of the 15th Amendment.
Interesting. And getting back, all right, so let's move back to Section 5 here, because, you know, we're not going to resolve that. And, of course, that's a function of, I mean, that's going to be an interesting aspect, I would imagine, of the debate that we're going to see in the Supreme Court when they begin to hear this case on the 27th of this. But one question, I just got this IM, and I hadn't even realized it, but there are three counties, is that right, in New York State that are covered by the Voting Rights Act? Bronx, Kings County, and New York County. I presume that it was the same measure for those counties. Is that right?
Those counties were covered because they discriminated against language minority groups. That they discriminated against, I believe it was first Hispanic voters and then Asian American voters. And there are counties that are covered because they had English only information for language minority groups at the polls, which is prohibited under the Voting Rights Act. So that's why portions of New York are covered.
I would imagine the same for Florida and California as well.
Yeah. If you look at the states, though, that are principally covered by the act, the nine states that are fully subject to the act, which is Alaska, Alabama, Arizona, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, Texas, and Virginia, I mean, seven of those nine states are in the South. So really, the Voting Rights Act has its biggest impact in the South. That's where voter suppression laws are still concentrated. And that's, interestingly enough, the region of the country where demographic change in many respects is the most rapid. And
right.
So even though opposition to Section 5 has been around in the South ever since it passed, there is an intensification of efforts to get rid of Section 5 because conservatives want to put in new voting restrictions in places like North Carolina and South Carolina and Georgia to try to stem the tide of rapid demographic change.
And that really is at the heart of what's going on here, because that is why we're seeing such intense efforts to overturn the Section 5. And I mean, I imagine there's also an amazing story, or at least a significant story in terms of what was taking place in the Senate and the House in terms of negotiating and getting this law passed in terms of the implications of which states were on it and which weren't?
Yeah, there were. I mean, this all happened very, very quickly, you have to remember. There were the Bloody Sunday demonstrations in Selma in March of 1965, in which people like Congressman John Lewis, who was at that time a young civil rights activist, were brutally beaten by demonstrating for voting rights. 8 months later, LBJ introduced the Voting Rights Act, and it was signed by Congress in August of that year. And so there really weren't concrete plans to push a Voting Rights Act per se until the Bloody Sunday March, and that really accelerated the timetable. And so Congress, even though there was a significant numbers of Southern representatives in Congress who opposed this thing, it did pass overwhelmingly. And it's important to remember that there's been four reauthorizations of the Voting Rights Act subsequently. All have been signed by Republican presidents. The last reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act in 2006 was passed overwhelmingly by a Republican House in 2006 and signed by George W. Bush. And so what's really remarkable is how 7 years after that reauthorization, the fact that there was this bipartisan consensus that supported the Voting Rights Act as recently as 2006 has now collapsed. And you essentially have a Republican Party that was once proud of signing the Voting Rights Act leading the charge to try to overturn it. And that's not every Republican. You still have people, for example, like Representative James Sensenbrenner, who was the chair of the Judiciary Committee at the time, who supports the Voting Rights Act. But certainly the momentum within the Republican caucus is moving towards opposing, not supporting the Voting Rights Act.
And because it was reauthorized for 25 years, the only mechanism for conservatives at this point to attack it is through the Supreme Court. So who is bringing this case? Who are the plaintiffs here in this case?
So the plaintiffs are from Alabama, which again is interesting because Alabama, more than any other state, is responsible for the passage of the Voting Rights Act.
I'm going to have to do this. It seems just too perfectly apropos.
Surprise, surprise.
Good.
I remember. That really caught me off guard. The challenge originates in Shelby County, Alabama, which is an exurb of Birmingham, which, as many people know, was once regarded as the most segregated city in the country. Within Shelby County is a very white, wealthy Republican county. Within Shelby County, there is a town called Calera. Calera was a pretty small town, about 3,000 people in 2000. A lot of people moved there from Birmingham after 2000, so they did a redistricting in 2008 for local elections. There was one black member of the city council in Calera. He represented a district that was 71% African American. After the redistricting, his district was moved from 71% African American to 30% African American by adding all these white subdivisions to his district. The Justice Department opposed that change. They said that the city could have drawn a majority-minority district and chose not to. So what happened was the Justice Department objected to this change a day before the election in Calera. Calera held the election anyway, and this black city councilman lost. There was new elections in 2009 as a result of negotiations with the Justice Department. This black city council member won his seat. That seemed to be the end of it. But what happened is Shelby County decided to file suit challenging the constitutionality of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And we can talk about this, but the challenge itself was spurred on by a conservative legal defense fund in Washington.
Well, that's the point, too, right? I mean, the Calera and the Shelby County probably didn't have the money or necessarily the intense will to do this, but for a conservative legal fund that wants to challenge the Voting Rights Act. I mean, do we have a sense, before we go into who that fund is, or well, let's talk about who is that fund? Who's funding that fund?
Sure. So it's a one-man show called The Project on Fair Representation, run by a guy named Ed Blum. Ed Blum was a former stockbroker who ran for Congress in 1992 in Houston in a majority black district. He lost that district, but it convinced him that the VRA had turned into a nefarious force for racial gerrymandering. So he started this conservative legal defense fund called The Project on Fair Representation. It was initially housed at the American Enterprise Institute. He funded it to try to oppose the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act when it was reauthorized by Congress in 2006, he then started finding court challenges. And so he would find plaintiffs who would challenge not only the Voting Rights Act, but other race-based protections like affirmative action. He's also funding the affirmative action case before the Supreme Court that's been argued and will be decided this summer. And
this is a banner year for that guy.
It really is. And one of the reasons that he's been able to be so successful is he's funded exclusively by this consortium called the Donors Trust, which I don't think most people know about. But it's a consortium of right-wing funders. And they get a lot of money from people, for example, like Charles Koch. And then Donors Trust gives out money. So they gave out $22 million in 2010 to a whole who's who of conservative groups, including the American Legislative Exchange Council, Grover Norquist, et cetera, et cetera. This group is funding Blum, so that he's received $1.2 million from Donors Trust in the last 5 years. And that's allowed him to find these plaintiffs and then hook them up with very influential Washington lawyers. So he's been the catalyst to get these cases like affirmative action and the Voting Rights Act before the Supreme Court.
How much plaintiff shopping did this guy do? In other words, were there other attempts, were there other cases that did not, that he pursued? Did he have other plaintiffs? How is it, were they, I imagine that he was looking around for these cases. He found some other ones, but maybe they just didn't go as far. What's the history of his attempts to find the perfect plaintiff that would be amenable to this, amenable, I should say, to this Supreme Court?
So 8 days after Bush signed the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act in 2006, there was a Blum-sponsored case from Texas that was filed challenging the constitutionality of Section 5. It was heard 100 days after Obama's inauguration. And what the court did in that case is they said that this small local utility that was challenging the law, that they could, quote unquote, bail out of the Voting Rights Act and from Section 5. So places with a clean record can get out of Section 5, which I think is important to note. And the Supreme Court said that this utility from Texas could get out. But the court also said, John Roberts, writing for the majority, said that he had serious constitutional questions about the Voting Rights Act. And that basically ensured that there would be another challenge. And at that point, when Blum had lost before the Supreme Court in 2009, although been given a green light for future challenges, he went out and found the Shelby County case and really put that on a fast track before the Supreme Court. So we're in this weird situation where in 2009, the Supreme Court heard a challenge to Section 5, and now just 4 years later, they're going to hear another challenge.
And this is, this is a really important dynamic for people, I think, to understand in terms of the way that the Supreme Court works. We see this time and time again in terms of the law changing in both directions, frankly, regressively and progressively, that the Supreme Court will take sort of tangential or ancillary cases that begin to chip away and basically set up and create sort of a body of decisions that will set up for a case like this. So, I mean, we can look to the Affordable Care Act ruling and say the court has set up certain potentiality in the future to change the law of the land in some respects because it has chipped away at the Commerce Clause. In this instance, we saw the Supreme Court use this first case as a way of perhaps basically setting up this one. And I think, and I don't know if you've done any reporting in this regard, but I think it's naive to presume that there isn't indications both in the opinions that the Supreme Court justices write and through sort of their associations as to what kind of case the Supreme Court is interested in hearing.
Well, and John Roberts has made it very clear that he wanted to challenge Section 5. John Roberts made his name as a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department by opposing the expansion of the Voting Rights Act. It was a different provision of the Voting Rights Act, but Roberts has a long history of activism against the Voting Rights Act. And it's important to remember just how radical a decision would be striking this law down. I mean, this is something, Section 5, that's been upheld in four different Supreme Court challenges. This is considered the most important civil rights law passed by the Congress, one of the most important pieces of legislation passed ever by the Congress. And this was something that was reauthorized overwhelmingly in 2006. And so what the court is going to say here, if they strike down Section 5, they're basically going to say to Congress, you didn't have the authority to overwhelmingly reauthorize this law. And that's a very, very slippery slope. That decision would have ramifications well beyond the Voting Rights Act and imperil all other pieces of legislation that Congress passed to try to remedy discrimination in one form or another.
It also, I mean, just in terms of like broader, judicial philosophy, this is one of those classic cases that conservatives supposedly always have a problem with, right? Which is overturning duly passed legislation by Congress. I mean, this is what they consider to be judicial activism essentially.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it would be a very, very radical decision. It would go against a long line of precedent. It would invalidate a historic piece of legislation. And there's already a mechanism for people who have clean records to get out from Section 5, can bail out from the act. And since this 2009 court case that I referred to earlier in the piece that the Supreme Court heard, states and counties are increasingly bailing out of the act in record numbers. And so basically what states are saying is that they want to be able to keep discriminating, because if they stop discriminating, they could get out from the act. So they essentially want a green light to keep discriminating against minority voters.
When states and counties bail out of the act, do they do so with Department of Justice approval? Is that essentially the mechanism?
Yes. And more jurisdictions have bailed out in the last 3 years than that had bailed out in the previous 27 years.
And what is the criteria for doing that?
That has tried to bail out has been turned down. So states can bail out of this, but you have to have a clean record to be able to bail out.
And so what is the principle upon which the plaintiff is arguing? And again, we should say here that the plaintiffs aren't arguing that they should not be subjected to the Section 5. They're not saying our statistics show that we should not, that Section 5 should not be applied to us. They are arguing that Section 5 is unconstitutional. Is that right? Based upon what principle?
So they are saying that the Section 5 was meant to be a temporary provision based on an emergency situation in the South, and that quote-unquote emergency is over, and that things have changed in the South sufficiently that the South should no longer be targeted. It's unconstitutional for Alabama to be treated differently than Michigan. Now, the problem with that argument is that there are statistics upon statistics, one of which I just mentioned earlier, that Alabama is much worse than Michigan, that there are more likely to be challenges not only under Section 5, but obviously under other provisions of the Voting Rights Act, for example, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, that 81% of successful Voting Rights Act lawsuits occur in places covered by Section 5. So clearly discrimination is still concentrated in those states. And the fact that there is voter suppression going on in Michigan would seem an odd reason to say to Alabama, well, now you get a green light to do this, the same kind of stuff.
I mean, part of the reason why finding a decision that somehow the Section 5 is unconstitutional on those grounds is that if you're arguing that it was temporary, that it was meant to be temporary, then you're also arguing implicitly that it was constitutional to deal with an existing situation. If you cannot prove that that existing situation has gone away, there's no reason to argue that the Section 5 is now unconstitutional for some reason. if you are arguing that it was meant to be temporary, there seems to be ample evidence that it was temporary for those states that have been able to opt out once they have proven that they have sufficiently corrected the problem that made Section 5 constitutional when it was implemented. There's going to have to be a lot of pretzel twisting for the Supreme Court to find this act sort of on its face unconstitutional.
Well, the question is this going to be an empirical judgment or is this going to be an ideological judgment?
They're going to rule.
Yeah, but what I'm going to say is if you have justices on the court that have a long history of being skeptical of remedies to racial discrimination, John Roberts certainly falls in that camp. Anthony Kennedy is more of a swing vote. He is someone who has praised Section 5 as recently as 2009, but has also worried that it doesn't make sense to treat, as I mentioned earlier, Alabama different than Michigan. And even though in 2009 the evidence was presented before Kennedy that states like Alabama were much worse in terms of discrimination than states like Michigan, he really was obsessed with this point. And I don't know if the evidence of the 2012 election, the thing I mentioned earlier, that two-thirds of the states that are fully covered by Section 5 passed new voting restrictions, but only one-third of the states that aren't covered by Section 5. So I don't know if that's going to sway the justice, but I think there's a differentiation between Kennedy and Roberts on this. I think Roberts is more openly hostile. There's definitely four votes to overturn it. And the question, as it is with all of these cases, is what will Kennedy end up doing? Will he take a very radical position like he took in Obamacare, or will he take a more progressive, restrained position like he has done in earlier cases that have upheld remedies to racial discrimination?
There are people in the Federalist Society right now having a heart attack with the sort of the juxtaposition of progressive, restrained decision, as you refer to it. But in the course of your reporting, do you have a sense of how the Obama administration, the Justice Department, is contemplating what they would do in the event that Section 5 is struck down? Because it seems to me at that point, if it is struck down on the grounds that it's unfair to treat Alabama differently from Michigan, then there is, at the very least, and I don't know whether or not it could pass, but an argument that, okay, we're going to have to do this. We're going to have to add attorneys at the Justice Department, and we're going to have to suggest legislation that says everyone is subjected to a preclearance, prior to any, let's say they create a new floor for a threshold. What type of decisions might change? The have genuine impact on the electoral process
the problem is that any change is going to have to pass Congress, and I don't expect House Republicans, given the current makeup of the Congress, to pass any sort of new fix to the Voting Rights Act.
I would agree with that too, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you don't start to create this legislation and contemplate it. I mean, surely.
No, you create it, but in the interim, the Justice Department would be really hamstrung because the Justice Department is acting based on congressional authority. And so any kind of new legislation would have to pass Congress. So, you know, if the court doesn't uphold the act and they don't fully strike it down, but they instead say to Congress, you need to quote-unquote fix this, which I think is a fairly likely outcome, that's as good as killing it for now, because this Congress is not going to pass a new extension of the Voting Rights Act, and it's certainly not going to pass an extension that puts more states as part of this. That's just not going to happen.
Wow. This is going to be an incredible – so give me a sense of just the case begins on the 27th. What happens at that point? I mean, we have a couple of days of oral arguments, and then
it's one day, and it's about an hour. I mean, people forget that Supreme Court cases are very, very short, and the oral arguments don't last very long. There's been a plethora of briefs followed, filed on both sides, so there's a huge volume of briefs before the court. I don't know how many of those they will read, but the case will be heard on February 27th, and then it's likely that there will be a decision in June. It's shaping up to be a very, very consequential Supreme Court term. We're going to have decisions on the Voting Rights Act, on affirmative action, and also Prop 8 and the Defense of Marriage Act. So it's one of the most important Supreme Court terms, I think, certainly in my lifetime and perhaps in the last 50 or 100 years.
And is there a commensurate sort of outside political sort of response to this? In other words, you know, one of the things that there was some speculation that influenced John Roberts' decision in the Affordable Care Act was the amount of attention it was getting. And it seems to me that I haven't heard anyone short of yourself. You know, maybe I've seen some small pieces, but I haven't heard of any political organizing around this at all. I mean, because the, you know, presumably if there was to be, if there had to be some type of, if they threw it back to Congress and said, you have to remedy this, that of course makes it explicitly political. But one would imagine that you'd want some sense that, hey, look, the country's watching. You know, and paying attention to that.
I think there needs to be more pressure put on the court. I think that more people need to talk about it. I think more people need to talk about the level of radicalism that there would be. There's been a number of congressional briefs filed by people like Harry Reid, but also by people, Republicans like James Sensenbrenner in the House. And I think those people need to speak up more, talk about what the ramifications would be. And I also think that people need to start thinking, well, what happens? What do we do if they strike this down? Or what do we do if they say, fix this? Is there some sort of plan that you can put out there and start pushing so that people aren't just caught like they were after the Citizens United decision with no answer and still have no strategy for overturning it? So hopefully the Voting Rights Act and the voting rights community is further along in terms of their activism than the campaign finance community was. And I mean, you just have to look at what happened very recently. I mean, in Virginia, we had a situation,
right,
as I'm sure you've talked about on this show, where on Martin Luther King Day, when an 81-year-old civil rights activist was out of town, the Virginia Senate Republicans passed a redistricting plan.
It's 2020 in the Virginia Senate, and he was out of town, so it was 1920. Is literally.
Yeah, and they passed a redistricting plan that would have hurt black voting strength in 8 to 12 districts. And this is a state that's subject to Section 5. And this just happened 3 weeks ago.
Now, so, my understanding is they backed off that, right?
The House backed off it. But it's hard to argue that things have changed in the South when Virginia Republicans would do something like this on Martin Luther King Day, when, of all people, a civil rights lawyer was out of town. I mean, I think that's kind of the best evidence you need that places like Virginia still need to be covered under Section 5.
I can't see Antonin Scalia being terribly sympathetic to that. But who on the left is sort of the to the extent that there is anybody who is paying attention to this and the possible implications of a decision that, you know, where that the Voting Rights Act, that Section 5 is inoperable until it's fixed or we're going to overturn it or something like that. What organization, through your reporting, is the seems to be the sort of the beachhead, or that is doing the most work in trying to plan for that potential outcome?
Well, I think first, in terms of just the legal challenge, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund has really been organizing the response to the case. And so they've been the ones that have been providing, I think, the most informative briefs and that have been pulling together all the different communities to say why the Voting Rights Act is important, from conservative Republicans like James Sensenbrenner to traditional civil rights groups. You had, during the 2006 reauthorization, you had a very large coalition of people under the rubric of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights that was defending this bill. I think you'll see that coalition come together. Again, I think as we get closer to the decision, you'll hear more people speaking out about the law. I kind of wanted my article to come out around now so people would have a few weeks to digest it, so they would actually know what was happening with this challenge before the Supreme Court hears it.
Yeah, it's important. In fact, I think we'll try and have somebody come on from that, from the NAACP to discuss it. I think I went to college with one of their lead litigators. So,
yeah.
Thank you for that, Ari. And, well, Ari, fascinating piece. It's something, obviously, that's hugely important, not getting enough attention. And I think it was rather thoughtful of you to do it at this time, as opposed to when, on February 27th, when everybody else will write this piece.
Thanks, Sam. I appreciate that.
Okay. And Ari, before you go, I am now probably around the time that this is being litigated in the Supreme Court. I'm involved in litigation right now regarding what we should name our son. Before you go, what do you got for a name suggestion?
Name him Moses.
You know, I had that was on there. My wife nixed that already, though. You got a second
Moses
one?
Moses Seder. Moses Seder, perhaps the Jewish name ever invented.
Well, I got to say, Saul is in the running, so I'm not sure.
Saul Seder. Just like Herman Berman, huh?
Is that... I got, how about Moses Shabbat Seder?
Yeah. No, I was playing around with Shylock Seder. I thought that was a little bit Jewisher. All right.
Well, good luck. Hopefully you resolve it soon. Sam.
Yes, yes. Well, don't worry. We'll cut that part out of the interview, Ari.
Talk to you later.
All right, bye-bye. Ari Berman, ladies and gentlemen.
Ari Seder.
There's a lot of argument for that in the House, actually. Folks, tomorrow on the program, we'll be mixing things up. We're giving Cliff Schechter a brief one-week vacation. That's all he gets. This is not Europe. That's all he's getting. Tomorrow on the program, Chris Hayes from Up with Chris will be joining us. In the better half of the program today, we will go a little bit further into these to preface and set up these hearings for John Brennan. We'll talk about a surprise endorsement for John Brennan's confirmation. Also, I think I mentioned Marco Rubio trying to thread the needle. Trying to thread the needle on climate change. He, I guess it's been announced he will be doing the rebuttal to President Obama's State of the Union address.
In Spanish and English.
Muy inteligente.
There's a great, I mean, it's really bizarre, though. All the guys who've given these rebuttals for the Republicans have not done well after they've done it.
Like they have Bobby Jindal, I think it destroyed stars. Bobby Jindal's career, frankly.
We set him back several years.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. So we'll see. I have a feeling Rubio will be a little bit better. He's pretty good at speeches. We got this story coming out of Michigan about the latest vaginal ultrasound bill. It's really amazing that these guys are so so focused on this. Interesting announcement of support for the post office to continue its Saturday delivery. We will discuss that in the better half of the program. And the story of these two daughters of the Phelpses who have basically escaped the Westboro Baptist Church. Interesting story in that respect. And folks, I know I make this appeal every day, and I know it gets a little bit annoying, but you know, we're net negative for members on the week, and I know, based upon the literally thousands of people who listen to this program, that some of you out there genuinely enjoy this show on a daily basis. You'd be bummed if it went away. You spend far more on cable bills that you don't watch their stations, or you have periodicals that you don't read as much, or that you you're only drinking half of your caramel macchiatos every day, and maybe you feel like you should cut out fancy coffees or whatever it is. Take that 33 cents that you save by getting the whatever it is, the grande instead of the venti. Is that, am I got that right? Or whatever it is. Yeah, none of these guys, none of us in here get coffee at a place where we can't just say small, larger, or medium. And put it towards supporting a program that you enjoy by becoming a member at majority.fm. Your support is what finances 97% of our revenue on this program, and it will help us out. We're putting money towards our app right now, and we'd like to up our video quality and, frankly, maybe ultimately expand the show. So please, your support is what keeps the show alive. You can join us in the better half of the program by calling 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. The IM is in effect. See you in the better half.